I'm Carol Parker Duncanson, and as Blaine said, I am the leader for our nutrition and health program in New York City that works with low-income families. So we have been doing this for over 40 years, doing nutrition education in the communities in many of the low-income neighborhoods in New York City. So I am a practitioner of nutrition education, primarily community nutrition education, and I'm affiliated to the university through the Cooperative Extension System. So, of course, that system, as I have on the slide, we have a public mission as a part of the land-grant university system, and that is to provide education and outreach and applied research, which is what we do, touching every aspect of life in New York. So that's what applies totally for our total land-grant system. And so the research, the word research is always a part of how we state our function. And so I need to point that out because we have, of course, I have two of our prime researchers with us here on the panel. And the component of the work that I do is the outreach part, translating that research knowledge into what people can do, okay? In New York City, again, we repeat the mission statement, our mission statement in New York City, advancing New York City through research. And this is what we do. Now, I thought that as a part of my presentation, I wanted for you to kind of have a little immersion experience similar to how we do what we do in the work that we're doing, because we're teaching families about nutrition and we're talking with them, and we have a very visual, hands-on type of experience where people leave our education environment with knowledge and behavior changes that are so important relative to what they do. So I just wanted to ask you, because you're all here because there's obviously an interest in this particular topic. And if I threw a question out to you, like, for instance, if you had to come up with maybe the top two issues or the top two things that you would identify as being two of the major factors that are associated with this obesity epidemic that we have in this country, what would you say that they were? And I'm actually asking the question.
Mm-hmm. Probably that a lot of times food that's not that nutritional is cheaper.
Okay, cheap, unhealthy foods. Okay, good. Anybody else? Any other ideas? Mm-hmm. Any thoughts? I mean, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Lack of exercise.
Okay, that's a good one. Mm-hmm. Anything else? And anybody would say, well, you know, what I know for sure, according to Oprah.
Probably a lot of body images are like too thin.
Okay.
I think women need to have some fat. I'm a personal trainer. It's one of the things that I do. And maybe some people think I'm never going to be that skinny, so mm-hmm.
Whatever.
So there's no balance. You need balance.
Okay, they give up, you know, whatever. I'm just going to do what it is. I'm never, ever going to look like a Twiggy or a Tyra or a somebody of that nature. So, you know, usually when we work with low-income families and we ask that question, many of them come up with some of the things that they say, that you say. But a lot of them talk about, yes, you know, we also have too many fast food restaurants in our neighborhood. My kids are watching too much TV, and they talk about candy and soda and stress and all kinds of different things. So this is a popular way that we do to sort of engage people and have them to start thinking, because it's so important to get their idea about what they think before we start to impart our research-based knowledge. And we respect their knowledge and their experience in terms of interacting with them and, you know, motivating them to change their behavior. Now, what we do in our program in delivering nutrition and health, we deliver it in a manner that is focused on utilizing what we call indigenous frontline educators. And that's important for you to understand, because when we work in low-income families, the educators that we hire are the people from the community. We train them in some nutrition content, a significant amount of nutrition content, and then we send them back to teach their neighbors and their friends and their children. And they're the most effective means that we have found through research in terms of delivering comprehensive nutrition education with long-term behavior change. So this is our educator working. We're using our USDA-approved material, our education materials, and we're involving them in a lot of different types of activities. So this is what our personal goal is. Fun, of course, is a word that's interactive and definitely with a personal touch. So we include families, oftentimes with young children. That's our major target audience. We build in physical activity experiences for them, and food is a big piece of it. Okay, in terms of what we do. Here we are, engaging in physical activity. We do a lot of work with youth in classroom settings, after school, summer youth, vacation, Bible school. We do all of that kind of stuff. A lot of work with seniors and the elderly. food shelters, you know, homeless programs, pantries and soup kitchens, a lot of that work. And a part of it also is we do group supermarket tours because we want to talk about the marketplace. When you're in the store, how are you going to be making choices? So we are oftentimes involved in doing some of those. And our participants all receive a certificate of completion after they've done our series, which actually is a requirement, certainly, if they want to work with us. So many of our recipients we hire for the, you know, to come and become our employers. Here we are outside in the field, in farmers market, health fairs, and other kinds of things, doing a lot of this kind of work. So I wanted you to see an image of that, only because, and you could, only because it gives you a visual perspective of the work that we do and how we're doing it. Our focus is on behavior change. The elements primarily are diet quality, you know, food safety, feeding children, food resource management, how to stretch the food dollar, a major component of what we do. And so the task of taking the research and making it evidence-based, you know, taking the evidence-based research and making it practical is where our expertise comes in working with families. And we do this by taking the recommendations that are made and converting it into the how do I do this. And that is what we have found to be, you know, the way that we have had the greatest impact. We use visuals and hands-on, as you could see from the picture, and we also have an evaluation component. We're a research organization. We just can't do programming and not have an evaluation component. So we have a pre-assessment of behavior and also of dietary intake. And we have a post-assessment after we've had a 6 to 8 week intervention. And from that data, we've been able to see the outcomes and the impacts that we've had on intake, certainly, and on behavior practices. So this is a built-in component, and it's something that I said we've been doing it for years. Our funding comes from the U.S. Department of Agriculture. So with that funding, of course, primarily through our SNAP-Ed program, many of you have heard of that before, but also our expanded food and nutrition education program, the acronym FNEP. These are the programs that our funding sources come, and a part of that funding source requires that certainly we use the USDA researched material that are developed and made available for the public as a part of our teaching resource. So I would, you know, say that our Bible, probably, from which we get our information in terms of teaching, would be the Dietary Guidelines for Americans. And we, of course, use other materials like the Choose My Plate information, things from Team Nutrition, and other kinds of publications. Those are the materials that we use to teach. So as I was preparing for this presentation, I certainly went through reading umpteen research articles, literature, you know, I mean, looking at, I just came from a Society of Nutrition Education conference in Washington, D.C., so, of course, did a lot of that, you know, talked to a lot of different people, and then also decided that I was going to do some underground research myself. So I was in Washington, D.C., and we were staying in the Shoreham area, which is near Adams Morgan, okay, at a hotel there. And I decided, I just want to be a fly on the wall, you know, just walking into the low, they don't have bodegas or corner store in that area of Washington, D.C. So the closest place to get some beverages in a bottled setting would be the CVS. There's a big CVS on the corner. And I said, let me just go in and see what the environment is like. We were going through a heat wave. It was like 98 or, you know, whatever, close to 100 degrees on Monday and Tuesday. So I went in and I said, well, let me take a look at the, you know, the refrigerated beverage section. And I counted each panel. There were like 14 panels of beverages. And in that, the 14 panels of beverages, there were actually 3 with water and 8 with what we consider to be sweetened beverages, including Gatorade, vitamin water, you know, the soda things. There were 8 of those. And the smallest size was a 20-ounce bottle. I was hoping to probably see a 10-ounce can. And then I was thinking, but wait a second, you know, I haven't seen 10-ounce cans in these showcases in a long time. But we had 20 ounces all the way to 32 ounces. So I looked and I counted the panel, I checked, and I said, well, if I walked into the store, the first 3 panels I would see were sweetened soda beverages, okay? But then there was a panel of water. Then I walked 5 more with the increasing sizes, incrementally increasing sizes, I noticed, because I had to put my glasses on to see, there was a 23-ounce can, and I went to 28, and then I went to a 32-ounce Gatorade. And then there were two panels with water on the end. So I said, well, you know, hung around a little bit. Let me see what people are doing. Folks came in. It's nice and hot out. The bus, you know, the bus stop is right there. The metro is right there. Folks came in. They grabbed, you know, they went to the sugar thing and they grabbed, and some folks grabbed water or whatever. And I was just thinking, because I was with Brian once a few, you know, a couple of days earlier, and I'm thinking, mindless. It came to my mind. I said, wait a second, mindless drinking. Because I'm not, I know that the people that I observed, it was about, what, 15, 20 people at the time, I don't think any of them thought about what they were doing. They just opened a glass and they reached in, took something out, and of course it was put in a bag. And the thing about it, that beverage is for one person. There was nobody buying something without, you know, getting an extra cup or thinking that they were going to get two straws to share it. They were going to be using it only for themselves. So I came back from New York City and I spent some time yesterday in the South Bronx. The mayor was, there was a big release of a Shop Health in New York City thing in the Bronx yesterday. So I went into a Bronx bodega. I was able to find one in the area of the Bronx that I was. Went into the bodega. I did sort of the same estimation of the whatever. And I saw that the showcase panels for sweetened beverages was at least three or four times what it had for what I would consider healthier beverage choices. And for them, the healthier beverage choice would have been water. I also went into the 7-Eleven around the corner on 34th Street, and I had a wonderful surprise this morning. I walked in there, and on the 7-Eleven, you know, there were like four or five panels with sweetened beverages. At eye level, there was an 8-ounce bottle of Pepsi, a Diet Pepsi, that was in there. One shelf, okay? And there was one rack, one panel with 10-ounce sodas, but everything else was 20 ounces or more. So I said, wow. I looked at the bottle of the, I recognized it from the past, the new bottle of the 8-ounce Pepsi. And many of you here look quite younger than I am, but many of you might not have remembered that there was a time when women wanted to have a Coca-Cola bottle shape. It was actually what women wanted. It looked like the new 8-ounce, you know, Coca-Cola bottle. And I was having that image of that 8-ounce Coca-Cola bottle shape that we desired when I was young, to what the shape now is of, you know, of our new, you know, our 20 and larger bottles. But I found it, 8 ounces on one shelf. And I said, wow, that's a choice that people have in that particular situation if they wanted to make it. It wasn't a lot, but at least it was there. So people could actually make the choice. So the reason why I'm saying all of this is because our dietary guidelines, literally, we call it our Bible from which we get our information. They have two basic recommendations around, you know, two basic recommendations. That's the premise of the dietary guidelines. The first one is maintaining calorie balance over time to achieve and sustain healthy weight, okay? And the second one is to focus on consuming nutrient-dense foods and beverages. So how do we help our participants in the climate that we have right now to follow that particular recommendation, certainly as it relates to consuming sweetened beverages? We teach them about portions. How much? How much are they eating? We use props like this to relate to people that the social norm of sizes right now is very different from it was 30, 40 years ago. Our average plate size has moved from a 9-inch to 10 3/4 inches, sometimes 12, or it could go up to 12 or 10. I don't know if any of you have eaten that. What is the name of that? Italian food restaurant, Olive Garden. You know, they serve you in a platter. So it's not even a plate anymore, it's a platter. I brought these things from home because I wanted to share with you the fact that in my home too, you know, we have an issue with portion size as much as we try to do things. And so the average cup, you know, we have people who love this cup here. Our bowls have moved now to, I measured this morning, 22-ounce bowl. Okay, this is what my children are drinking cereal out of. So their norm is not the norm of 20 and 30 years ago. When I was telling you that I was looking for a teacup. Do you know, did anybody remember the 8-ounce teacup that came in a saucer? If you look at the diningware right now, they don't have those sets anymore, except if you're buying this wonderful china, you know, whatever, for a wedding present or whatever, but your everyday stuff is not those. These are your everyday things. And I have this because this is the smallest drinking glass that I have at home. And this is a typical one that my children are drinking out of. Everything, okay? I remember that there was a time when I grew up when our cup sizes looked more like that. But they're not that anymore. You know, it's a society that we're living in right now when a small coffee is called grande or tall, you know, whatever. So you know that we are at the point where our social norm in terms of portion size have totally shifted. So we bring these things to our participants and we show them. And we know that these are some of the things that they have at home. Some of them bring serving bowls and they say, you know, well, we're eating out of one of those things that they have in the back. That's what my kids are eating out of. So we're going to now take them from how to shift from this to making healthier choices. So we talk about portions, how to reduce intake of sweetened beverages. Don't even buy it. Do not bring it in the home. Start right there. Don't put it on the table and serve it as a meal. You don't sit with soda and then insist that your children drink, you know, milk or whatever. Just avoid it. So we give them that kind of information in terms of that. One of our major concern with this is because the intake of those sweetened beverages, it's displacing the healthier choices, which would be maybe 100% juice in some instances, you know, low-fat milk and dairy, and certainly the ultimate thirst quencher, which is water. So when we talk about reducing portion sizes, we include those kinds of messages. The other issue that we teach, which is just practical about what they can do within the home, is to be mindful of the environment. You know, many of our families are saying, well, you know, there's, and they don't have to tell me because I go in the neighborhood, I work in it, and I go through it. There's a Chinese food location, a store on every block. There are bodegas on every corner. When you go in, you see the options that they have in their face. It's in their face, in the present, and how that prompts their choices oftentimes. And it becomes like mindless choosing or mindless decision making sometimes, that you're just doing things only because. You know, so we talk with them about the access. And this particular concept of environmental factors that might affect their choices, it's not an easy thing to teach because people are just not aware. Many of our families are so bogged down with other kinds of things that they're just not thinking. They know they don't have and they probably just accept it. And so this is what we're finding. And it's everywhere. It's where we live, where we work, and where we play. You know, when you go to a playground and the soda vending machine, I mean, the vending machine is a, you know, is some kind of sweetened beverage, those are the things that you choose as opposed to if you only had water. So no matter how much we teach folks about their environment, the thing is that we can't move them out of the environment. They're there. They live it. You know, so with the battle for us is giving them the nutrition behaviors and having them become aware of it and still helping them and asking them to make choices. So the changes in the environment as it relates to the marketplace is a big issue for us. And, you know, I really want to, in terms of my feelings about this particular policy change, is the fact that the responsibility to change the environment, I find, is a collective responsibility. You know, we often say it's an individual, but I think actually it's a collective responsibility. And it requires a collective response. So I feel that if it's recognized as being important and it's expected that recognition and expectation is at all levels, which include policy levels, prevention levels, healthcare levels, education levels, and in the marketplace, that I would, you know, in our position as community nutrition education, I support policies, let me say that, that are aligned with our goals of using evidence-based information to inform our teaching and the message that we teach and from the research that I know that I've read and I'm aware of and I'm conscious of is that increased portion, increased consumption. And so, you know, in thinking about our social norm and the shift that we have right now, we don't know for sure whether this policy is going to work. And most likely, it can, in some way, in its intent to reduce access and availability. And maybe it will help in shifting our social norm again. Maybe. We don't know for sure. But the bottom line, which is a term that is often used in the marketplace, is that our families aren't even talking about it. In the communities that I work, there's nobody talking about the soda man. There's no discussion. it's not a thing that people and families are worried about. It's not a major part of their thought process at this stage. So my perception is that they're faced with so many other major issues right now to deal with, that they're probably depending on institutions and for government to make decisions and implement policies that will benefit them in the long run. And that's, you know, my perception, that they're actually depending on a collective response and for the institutions and the government who they trust the most of the time to, you know, come up with decisions and make some policies that will affect them in the long run. So that's my statement.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Mm-hmm. And Lewis?
So, you call this a single serving of soda? Or I was yelling at Blaine because he doesn't have a bottle of soda for everybody. Aren't you all upset that you didn't get one of these? We'll come back to that later.
But the soda ban, consumers deserve freedom to choose. Something you've heard, right? There's no question that they do. But they deserve freedom to choose small portions if they want them, is my point of view. They are being held captive. I believe that consumers are being held captive by the companies that are selling the portion sizes. They're setting portion sizes, and that it's put consumers, particularly adolescents and teenagers, in a situation that is very unhealthy, and it's a situation that is obesogenic. And I'm going to show you the evidence that obesity, once it begins, may be very difficult to return from. So it's sort of, one of the things we've recognized is it's kind of a one-way pass, a one-way ticket on the road to bad health. And what is it with the obesity epidemic? Like, why does this keep happening, and why don't people who are obese just get with it and lose weight? Now, this is the obesity epidemic. This is from the National Health, Nutrition, and Exercise Survey, 1960-62 to 2007. Overweight, stable, obesity increasing dramatically, and extreme obesity going from 0.9% to 6%. So the biggest increase, so now 73.9%, 74% of the population, 3 out of 4 people are obese, and the increase has come in obesity, body mass index greater than 30. Overweight has been stable. That's a little bit unusual. It's not that everybody's gained a pound or two, it's at this end of the spectrum. And if we dissected even further, if we looked at BMI greater than 30, BMI greater than 40, BMI greater than 50, we see that there's almost an acceleration in the increase in these BMI categories, so that the biggest increase is in the highest BMI range. And I would argue that that suggests that there is a physiology behind this. It's not that everybody's eating 100 more calories a day, it's that something physical is pushing people once they get to a certain threshold. They get to a certain point and they're being pushed higher and higher. This is the increase over the past 5 years. BMI greater than 30 increased 24%, greater than 40 was 52%, greater than 50 was 75%. And these are very, very worrisome trends. These are the people who cost a lot of money in the healthcare system. You know, I'm not here to talk about that, but these are the people who cost us thousands, millions, and billions of dollars in the healthcare system in the increased risk of complications. Now let's look at football players, okay? The healthy specimens of the NFL. The past 30 years, football linemen are 68 pounds heavier. This is the mean weight of linemen on the winning team in the Super Bowl. It's from the New York Times, and then I looked at the team that won in 2011. It was the Green Bay Packers. Their offensive linemen were 316.3 pounds back in 1972, 248.2 pounds. Like, what is going on that keeps pushing weight higher and higher? How do you do this? And the biggest concern we have is among adolescents, teenagers, children. Right now, 34% of adolescents, that's 12 to 19-year-olds, are overweight or obese. The most prevalent cardiovascular disease risk factors are there in the overweight and obese. The rate of diabetes and pre-diabetes rose dramatically from 9% a few years ago, 1999 to 2000, to 23%. 49% of overweight and 61% of obese adolescents have more than one risk factor. But here's the thing I want to point out, that in June, we diagnosed 4 18 and 19-year-olds with diabetes and pre-diabetes. Okay, 4 in 1 month. We have never, like, we'll have one here, one there. There are months where we have none. In June, which is when we see more teenagers, because school is over, we saw four of them. And they cut across socioeconomic path. They're all across, from high to low. And to me, this is more than the tip of the iceberg. This is very, very worrisome because it tells us that teenagers are not going to be protected from the diseases of obesity. In fact, it looks to me like they're developing these problems earlier than adults, where adults sort of percolate along for decades. We're seeing it's like an entire lifetime of illness compressed in, you know, 10 years. These are typically teenagers who started gaining weight when they were 9, 10 years old, and then they gain a tremendous amount of weight in early adolescence, and by the time they're 19, they have adult-type diabetes. And interestingly, many of them, we see that their parents had it, developed diabetes when they were in their 40s or 50s. Their grandparents developed it in their 60s or 70s. Now, this is a very typical pattern. And this is why we're so concerned. There are now more than 60 diseases associated with obesity, more than 60. And in the past, we used to say, gee, how does being overweight and obese cause a disease? That can't really happen, but now it is crystal clear that the hormones that come from fat cells combined with inflammation that is caused by excess fat in and around the abdomen and other parts of the body triggers the diseases that we associate with obesity. And the reason it's so powerful as a disease-causing entity is that there are multiple hormones. There are many different hormones that all occur at the same time. So for something like breast cancer, for example, you have growth factors, estrogen, inflammatory hormones, all of which promote breast cancer. So what happens? You have a tremendous increase in the risk of developing breast cancer in obese women, and that is not going to change. It's getting, again, earlier and earlier in generations. The big ones, diabetes, coronary heart disease. Now, recently, people have been saying, gee, wow, it's great, we're treating coronary disease, people are doing better than ever. What we aren't saying is that they're developing coronary disease at an earlier age. So one of the reasons that people are doing better is that now they're physiologically younger than they used to be. So instead of being 70 years old, now you've got 35-year-olds developing coronary disease, and so they do better when they go for a bypass. These are some of the statistics that get lost in the data. Now, I wanted to point out this paper, which, you know, to me is a really, makes a really important point. And this is by three primary groups of researchers from around the country. Obesity is associated with hypothalamic injury in rodents and humans. Okay? Obesity associated with hypothalamic injury. That is damage to the brain. I'm not going to go into this in detail, but basically what this lays out is an incredible series of experiments that show that feeding animals fattening food, food that causes them to become obese, overloads hypothalamic neurons. And as a result, when these neurons are overloaded, it's almost like a transformer, an electrical transformer being overloaded with electricity, it can blow out. And when that happens, eventually there may be fewer and fewer neurons to handle the signaling load, the load of signals coming from the fat cells, from the intestine, from other parts of the body, which tell the brain how much fat is stored. So what do the higher centers of the brain do to keep the signaling the same? They try to expand fat mass and increase the amount of food that's coming in. That is the wisdom of the brain. The brain says, okay, let's amplify the signal. But what this seems to lead us to is the ratcheting phenomenon, the thing that is causing weight to go up, 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 and not be able to go back. And again, that's not the topic of the discussion, but the point is, this points us in the direction of the interface of the environment and something physical that's going on, something physical that changes in the body that makes obesity inexorably move up, 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 and never want to move back. Okay, and again, I'd be happy to answer questions about it. But this is a hypothetical model we've put together, you know, very simple. High fat, high carbohydrate foods causing this hypothalamic injury. They identify a very specific neuron called POMC neurons that are injured. There's not as good remodeling in animals with a tendency to obesity. As a result, the brain seems to not be able to tell how much fat is stored. There's more fat mass to restore the equilibrium, so the cerebral cortex and other centers can feel the way they're supposed to feel, that there's a reduced sense of fullness and an increase in cravings. That increases food intake. There's fat mass gain. That actually increases hypothalamic injuries, right? How do you equilibrate the system? You take in more food. That increases hypothalamic injury by putting more strain on the neurons, and boom, you're back where you started from. So, and we actually see this clinically, where people go through this very aggressive phase of weight gain. They almost don't know what's happening. They start gaining weight, and boom, they just start gaining, gaining, gaining. And we've gone back now and looked at some of our patients who we followed for 15 or 20 years, and we see that there's this brief period of time before we started aggressively managing them, where they may have gained 30, 40, 50, 100. 200 pounds, and then we started treating them medically or surgically, and that is what stopped it. So it brings up the question of whether or not things like this, I mean, this was a long time ago, back in the 50s, should we start COLA earlier? When I was a resident, the hospital I worked at, there were ashtrays in the auditorium. Right? The hospital was built in 1955. You know, doctors would always be smoking. That was normal. When I took in the 1970s, taking pathology, a lung pathologist was a smoker. It's like, how is someone who's the head of lung pathology at a major medical center? He was at Hopkins. The guy would smoke cigarettes. He'd have to go outside, and he'd be back like a half hour later, and he smelled like smoke. And you're talking about lung pathology. But in any case, when it came to soda, you know, we wonder about these things. And so here's a, you know, I got these off the internet. Look at kids smoking cigarettes. And it could be that we will look at images like this, not just a kid drinking soda, but it's a lot of soda. And that may turn out to be shocking, the same way that a child drinking, smoking a cigarette is sort of a shocking or startling image to us. Some point in time. I wanted to show you a couple of papers that support this point of view, that, you know, maybe regulating the size of soda in an effort to allow people to choose smaller portions is a good idea. I'm Now, I'm going to get into this in a second. This is a study by Barbara Rolls and colleagues from a university in Pennsylvania. And they looked at 33 subjects, 18 women, 15 men. It's a crossover design. And what they did was give different portion sizes of soda, or diet soda or water. And they did a variety of things, switching around the size and looking at how much they ate at a meal that was served afterwards. And the result was that increasing beverage portion size significantly increased the weight of the beverage consumed, regardless of the type of beverage served. So here's their conclusion. Serving a larger portion of beverage resulted in increased beverage consumption and increased energy intake from the beverage when a caloric beverage was served. Okay, that was the bottom line. This was a very carefully controlled study. Another study by one of our colleagues, Brian Wansink, from upstate, was really very, very clever. And this doesn't have to do with soda, it has to do with popcorn. And many of you have heard of this study. This is a famous stale popcorn study. But what they showed was that they gave people either popcorn that was fresh or popcorn that was 2 weeks old, and they showed that when they gave them a bigger bucket of popcorn, even when it was stale old popcorn, they ate more popcorn, even if they didn't like it. So their conclusion, even when foods are not palatable, large packages and containers can lead to overeating. Okay, and they suggest that good ideas that maybe if they apply this to less preferred healthful foods such as raw vegetables, you can get people to eat more vegetables. So you give them the giant vat of raw vegetables, eventually they'll start eating more vegetables. So now, Carol, you went into this. What is small? What's medium and what's large? Okay, so here are some traditional ideas. Soda, 12 ounces, 20 ounces. Here's a 34-ounce bottle of soda. And this is 140 calories, 240 calories, and 400 calories. You should know that when the 20-ounce bottle first came out, it was a three portion. It was touted as three portions. That was enough for three servings. But how's this for choice? So this is from Kips Bay, the AMC Kips Bay movie theater, not far from here. Small, 32 ounces, 310 calories. Medium, 44 ounces, 426 calories. Large is 51 ounces. So how big is this? Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, how big is this? Let's see. What does it say?
20.
It's 34 ounces, it's a liter, so it's like 33.5 ounces, okay? That's small, so this is the size you're gonna get. This is the smallest size you get when you go to certain public venues. And again, I'm not pointing this out, but if you go to any large venue, that's going to be the smallest size. Here's a movie theater where they happen to have, our local movie theater has here's drinks, small, medium, large. They post the size, portion size, and the price. And it's hard to read, but 0 to 640 calories in the small. That's 450, 0 to 880. I'll go into this another slide. You can see it better. And here, large, 0 to 1020. Here's what it says. The small is up to 660 calories. Okay, that's pretty big. That's $4.50. Medium is up to 880 calories. That's $5. And large, 1020, that's 550. So there's a dollar difference. And it's, you know, it's not twice the size, but it's 80% more. So there's a strong financial incentive to increase portion size. Now, I'm not going to spend time talking about this, but there are many studies in animals showing that when you get in the range of sweetness of sugar-sweetened beverages, whether it's juice or soda or any of these, that animals will markedly increase their consumption of these things. And it's because it has certain receptors or whatever, but it's not very hard to get them to consume it. In fact, they'll consume 90% or more of their calories per day of sugar-sweetened beverages. They won't have anything else. Like they won't eat their normal mouse chow, they won't eat anything. They'll only drink the sugar-sweetened beverage. That's it. So it's not hard to get animals to eat or consume sugar-sweetened beverages, but to then give an economic incentive to increase the amount, I think makes it very, very difficult. So in conclusion, I think that the fact that the minimum size at many movie theaters and other public venues, go to garden, you know, place like that, is 32 ounces, that is really the issue here. And that trying to give people the option to choose a smaller portion is critical. There's an economic incentive to buy even more. The portion size is too large for teenagers and adolescents. Send your teenager and tell him this is the smallest size Coke you can get. This is the one you're going to get. Tell me, you know, he goes and gets $5 worth of soda like that, that a teenager is not going to drink the whole thing. And if you're an adult, you could buy 2, 3, or 4 sodas. You could buy 5 sodas. You could buy all the soda they have there. That's fine. You have plenty of options. Plenty of options are available to expand it. But in my opinion, there's no option to reduce the size where, you know, right now, the way the situation is, we are encouraging passive overconsumption. Okay? So you can tell that I'm in strong support of the soda ban.
Thank you very much. And David?
Sure. So just to give you an idea of who I am to begin with, I am a behavioral economist. I make my living doing behavioral studies, essentially field studies, where we go out and we run experiments on people in the real world to see how they respond to little things in the environment. And I'll mention here this research center that I lead, the Cornell Center for Behavioral Economics and Child Nutrition Programs. It's a center that's been open for a couple of years. We get our funding primarily from USDA. Co-directed with Brian Wansink, who is mentioned in both prior presentations, and we'll mention him again. And we've been looking at a lot of how, you know, kids can be led to make healthier choices on their own. And I'll come back to that idea, because I think it's actually a really important idea of how we can get people to make healthier choices on their own without sort of, you know, kicking them or holding something over their head to force them to do it, and why that might be a good idea. So let me start out, and we just talked about this study, so I'll go through it very quickly. If we look at the research behind this proposal, this proposed ban on larger sodas, they actually cited a lot of studies by Brian and a lot of others as well, saying exactly that if we have larger portions, people tend to eat more. In the case of popcorn, and in particular, in the case of stale popcorn, you double the size of that container and they end up eating about a third more. And that's a substantial number of calories, and why in the world people would do that with stale popcorn that was greasy and a week old, I don't know, but they do, okay? And we see this over and over again. There are actually dozens of studies that say something similar. It's true when you're dishing ice cream. It's true if we're talking about larger or smaller plates. It's true of anything that we've been able to see. But, and what's the but? The but is there are two important differences between these types of studies and what we're proposing here in New York City. And those differences are actually very important. One of the major differences is that these are randomly selected individuals. We had people coming into a movie theater, and as you're coming in, you say, "Hey, would you like some popcorn?" And they took whatever popcorn we gave them. We had no idea on, you know, when they were walking into the movie theater whether they were even thinking of buying popcorn or not. We just gave them popcorn. And that's a very different scenario than I'm walking into the store to buy a 32-ounce drink and I'm walking straight there. It's a very different notion of whether it's given to you, you know, whether you had decided you wanted it or not, or whether it's something that you specifically went in to buy. One is goal-oriented thinking, I'm going to get this. The other is, wow, that's a surprise. That's great, thank you, okay? So very, very different thinking. And the other piece of this is that the manipulation was surreptitious, okay? In other words, when we've done plate studies and we've had smaller plates or larger plates, people didn't notice that we had given them smaller or larger plates. We didn't say, somebody who comes in and says, I'd like a large helping of this, and say, we'll give you the small instead, right? Instead is just, we either gave them the large one or the small one, and it was in a setting where they're not going to be inspecting it, they're not going to be thinking about it, it is outside of their mind. It is mindless, okay? Those are two really, really big differences. And in real life, right, it's only those who want more than 21 ounces that are ordering more than 21 ounces, so long as there are smaller portions available, right? If the smaller portions are available, they'll order the smaller portions if that's what they want. And really, that's one of the big problems we face, is there is this lack of choice. My colleague called it, said perhaps it's soda companies that are sort of dictating to us and pushing these things on us. Well, in truth, yes, when there are things out there and there are certain sizes, whatever sizes they may be, when we see the size, it suggests a social norm. And we see this over and over again in our experiments. Whatever that social norm is, we tend to drink that amount or we tend to eat that amount. And if there are smaller social norms, we eat less. If there are larger social norms, we're going to eat more. But that social norm makes a difference. And if we had smaller sizes available, it might make a big difference in what people drink, but we don't. We have a lot of very, very large items out there. I'll come back to this in a couple of minutes. Secondly, like I said, people enter these establishments having some idea of what they want, rather than being selected randomly into it. We don't know whether it really is the case that these types of social norm effects work uniformly on those who wanted the larger size, right? That's just not what the research says. What the research says is you come in and you adjust portion size, and on average, people are consuming less if you have smaller portions. We don't know if that's the case for the people who are specifically targeting the larger sizes, and so we can't really say that, right? We've got to throw some caution out there. Maybe this is not as well tested as we would like to think. Let me continue. We've actually seen a lot of policies like this that were designed to get people to eat less fail. And I want to qualify that. There are several different reasons you might implement a policy like this. And for example, let's take the calorie postings in the fast food restaurants, right? Now, some people were really in favor of this because they thought this is going to reduce how much people eat. They're going to see the massive number of calories in these foods and they're going to stop eating this stuff. And if that was the purpose of the calorie postings, it was an utter failure, because we saw study after study after study looking at this and showing that calorie postings made no difference in how much people ate. In fact, one of the only prominent studies that actually found an effect, the effect was the exact opposite, that those who are dieting tend to eat more calories when we have the calorie postings. And why does something like that happen? Well, it happens because of what economists like to talk about as endogeneity, okay? The fact that there is this selection effect going on. If I am in a fast food restaurant and I'm on a diet, well, I've decided to go off my diet already, and those calorie postings suddenly mean something very different to me than what they would mean in a normal situation, right? Now, does that mean that we should nix all calorie postings? I don't think that's quite the case, because they do provide a lot of information, and I still do think people who know how to use that information and are looking specifically for it will probably be able to use it and probably benefit from it. I do think it should be publicly available. But we've got to be realistic about what it does, okay? In the moment, when people are tempted, when they are in that environment, that information is too complicated for them. What they want is food. What they think about is how it's going to taste and how it's going to make them feel full. Those are the things that are going to happen in the moment, okay? It's exactly those people who want these larger sodas who are going to people who are going to be the people who are the most resistant to this ban, okay? So so long as they've been able to buy smaller amounts, right, those people who are buying smaller amounts aren't affected by this, and they're the people who are probably most in favor of it. And the people who desire the larger amounts they're likely to try and work to find some way to overcome this ban. And what we call this behavior is it's reactance, okay? Psychologists talk about this as reactance. It's any sort of rebellion to a threat against freedom, okay? So a couple of examples I'll bring up from my own research. When we've, in an experimental setting, we've manipulated prices on food to try and see how people responded, and most of the studies out there that try and look at the potential impacts of fat taxes and things like that, they use normal price variation to try and figure out exactly how people are going to respond. Well, we thought there might actually be a difference between a change in price and a change in price that I say is a fat tax designed to get you to eat healthier, right? So we ran this experiment. We tried to figure out if we just change price, how do people respond? And if we change the price by the same amount and we say, here's a fat tax, what happens? Well, as you might expect, prices go up, people eat less of something or they buy less of something. But if you call it a fat tax, they don't reduce their consumption by nearly the same amount they would if you just raise prices on them, right? They're trying to fight against it. The fact that you're taxing me, that you're taking away my freedom, means I'm going to push back and I'm going to eat more of this, right? So to a certain extent, anytime we're going to throw out some sort of policy that works to restrict freedom, the individuals are going to put up some resistance that's going to erode its effectiveness to some extent. Now, that doesn't mean that it's going to be completely ineffective. It doesn't mean that, you know, people who like to drink huge sodas are now going to drink more of those huge sodas than they did before. We've just got to be realistic that this is going to erode some of the effectiveness of a policy like this. One very useful example of reactance that I like to use very often comes from one of the schools where we were doing some research. It's a very, very simple example. In this school, in order to meet the nutrition guidelines for school lunches, this school had did not allow students to take any more than one packet of ketchup with their lunch. Okay, so you ever try to use one packet of ketchup to spread all over your whatever chicken nuggets and fries and whatever else they might have been serving at the time? That's difficult. There's not a lot of it to go around. Okay, now the whole idea was to get kids to eat just a little bit healthier, but that's not the way the kids interpreted this. They thought saw this as egregious. Ketchup is never going to make me fat, they thought. This ketchup, I should be able to take two or three of these and cover these things. It's the other food that's really making, you know, the difference, that's the problem. And because they saw this as egregious, they rebelled. And they threw a protest. And this wasn't a very damaging protest, but it's illustrative nonetheless. Protest, the seniors on the day of graduation, at the ceremony, each senior, as they're walking by, shaking the hands of the principal, they had in their hand a packet of ketchup, right? Now, you might think, well, this is rather innocuous. If this is all that we get out of this, that might not be such a bad thing, that all we get, you know, a lot of packets of ketchup on graduation day. But think for a moment what they're doing. If they are that organized and that incensed to put together a protest, have we helped them form some new health habit? No. We haven't. When those kids are going to the McDonald's, they are not taking one packet of ketchup for whatever they've ordered. Instead, they're grabbing handfuls and handfuls and they're saying, free at last, and taking tons and tons of ketchup. They're doing exactly the opposite of what the policy was designed to do, because it was in a very limited circumstance. That's what I mean by eroding the effectiveness of a policy. We've got to worry a little bit about something like that. Now, that's the end of my slides. Let me talk a little bit about some other potential ideas. The thing that worries me the most about this soda ban is that it is not tested, right? We have not tried this out this way, and we don't know what it will do. This is, for all intents and purposes, much like the calorie postings, this is a full-scale field experiment in five boroughs, right? That's what it is. Because we haven't seen exactly what this is going to do and how it might affect people. Now, there might be some other ways to do something very similar and maybe even to be more effective. Now, I've pointed out a lot of the problem is the small end, right? We don't have that small amount available. And because we don't have that small amount available, You know, we don't have the smaller serving sizes available. Then we know people in that normal range probably are drinking more without really thinking much about it. They don't have any reactants to having, you know, large sizes are only there. It's sort of an asymmetric effect. What do you think would happen if, you know, New York City just simply went to the soda companies and said, we'd really like you to have smaller sizes available, and if you do that, we won't implement this ban? Do you think that might have a bigger impact? Or what do you think might happen if simply, for example, started regulating what you could call these sizes, whether you could call it a normal or a medium if it's something like this that is gigantic? Now, we've actually done a little bit of research along those lines, and believe it or not, you serve food, identical amounts of food, and if you call it a regular size, people eat almost all of it, about 95% of it, and you call that same serving size an extra large, and people will eat only about 75% of it. They'll reduce their calorie consumption simply by you manipulating what you call it. Now think about that, that's astounding, right? It's astounding. I can see the size, I feel how full I am, and it makes very little difference compared to whether I called it something large or small. It's again that social norming effect. There's a principle in economics. I don't like to speak too much economic ease, but if I have to, I have to. There's a principle in economics. It's called the principle of targeting. Okay, it essentially says something like this. If we want to accomplish this goal, then our policy should be designed to achieve that goal directly. And why do we do that? Well, this all comes out of welfare economics. It makes it so it's the least cost and least drag on everybody involved in that system. So if we want to reduce the number of calories people are consuming, we should be throwing a policy out there that's directed at reducing those calories, not just chopping it off at 21 ounces for and larger for people. Because when that happens, when we've just arbitrarily thrown in this policy, it creates costs for the consumers that we may not need to put in there and achieve the same goals. It creates cost also for the producers and the retailers that they may not otherwise be able to, you know, they may otherwise be able to find more flexible ways to obtain the same thing. I mean, when it comes down to it, the soda companies, they're selling bottles of liquid, and they care not whether there's sugar in it. In fact, they love selling bottled water. It's very low cost to produce, and they get the same amount of money out of it, right? There are a whole bunch of alternatives that they could employ that might be able to preserve their standing and preserve the consumer choices and still achieve the goal that the mayor wants to obtain. And I would think there could be some flexible ways to try and do that. Now, beyond that, I would love to see them actually do and maybe even fund some research about what their policies are going to do so that we know ahead of time, so it's not this full-scale experiment. Because while we've seen some that have had, you know, the intended consequence, we've also seen a lot that have had completely unintended consequences. For example, what happened in the LA school district when they got rid of all of the less healthy food in the LA school district, participation in the school lunch program took a nosedive. And if they're not buying the school lunch, they're probably buying something else, and it's probably less healthy. We've got to worry about this. It's got to be something more than just, I think this will do the right thing, so let's put it out there. I really would urge caution in that respect, and I'll quit there.
Thank you. Thank you very much, David. If all three panelists would join us, I'm going to put the microphone in the middle and open it up for some questions.
Question is for you, Dr. Judge. You talked about reactants. One of the victories that Mayor Bloomberg likes to throw out in this discussion is the smoking ban, and there is a lot of evidence that smoking in New York has gone down. I know that soda, drinking soda, is not the same as smoking, but was there reactants there?
There was. There was reactions there, and it did, I would think that it made the policy less effective than, you know, if you could have accomplished something in a different way that, you know, similar. The thing is reactants is just another cost you have to consider, right? I think about things like an economist, but I do. This is a cost that we have to consider in putting in a policy like this and determine whether there aren't other policies that can achieve the same thing without creating the same drag. Right, so yeah, there were some people when the smoking ban went into effect that that did everything they could to try and, you know, fight back at Mayor Bloomberg or whatever. There were bars that that tried to flout the law. There were you know, there were individuals who decided to smoke more than they had before, at least slightly, in order to try and fight this. It may have created some cost, and we don't know exactly what that was. We don't have, you know, full evidence on that, but it created some cost that, that made this a little less effective.
But in the end, it's, I mean, I think people agree that it has been effective.
Absolutely. So, merely by, say, larger families who decide to share sodas, or is this something that's primarily going to be borne by people who, you know, decide to work all day and just buy one soda in the morning or something like that? We don't know who's going to bear this cost. We don't know where that reactance is going to come from and how strong it's going to be, simply because we've never done the studies, right? Nobody's ever looked at it.
Any other questions?
Oh, sure.
Why not?
Nobody else is going to. Do you think that, I mean, the way that people behave, do you think that people are going to buy, you know, when they walk into the movie theater, do you think they're going to buy two sodas, or do you think that they're going to consume less?
So, with the movie theater sizes that we saw on the screen, I don't think very many people are going to buy multiples. It'll be limited to 21. With a 21, I think you would, right? I think you'll see some people who go ahead and buy multiples at 21 ounces. I again don't know what percentage that is going to be, but I certainly think some people are going to end up buying multiples. And whether they do or not, if they feel like they've been restricted, they're going to be resentful of this in some way. You know, how big is that effect going to be? That's something that really does remain to be seen. And as a, you know, I guess the question I have is, what's the goal? Is the goal to reduce soda consumption, or is the goal to reduce obesity? Because if the goal is to reduce soda consumption, I think this will have, you know, some pretty good effect. I worry a little bit about whether this is going to actually impact obesity directly, at least the way it's targeted, just towards the high end. And if it doesn't, what happens? Well, if it doesn't, this has become something that raises the ire of a lot of people, and at the same time is not particularly effective. And then it becomes, you know, it becomes a hiss and a byword, if you will, right? Other policies that could be effective won't be tried at that point because look what happened, right? We don't want that to happen to us. That's the worry. That's why you really got to know whether something's going to be effective before you just throw it out there, at least in my mind.
Go ahead, then we'll get you.
This is for Lewis O'Carroll. So as far as the ban, would you be more in favor of some other policy, like a tax, because I know both of you are very involved in nutrition, and it seems like this would only, that people would still drink a lot of soda. So would you be more in favor of something like a tax or any other policy?
Well, the tax related to additional cost of the item is something that has been proposed and talked about before, and I'm not really sure about, because I know, you know, the instances with cigarette were when, you know, when tax alone was applied, I don't think it had much of an effect on smoking. But when the restrictions in terms of, you know, where to smoke or whatever, that certainly had an effect. So I'm not sure if the tax, which would then increase the cost, if it would be as effective possibly as just not having access, because that's primarily what this ban is, limiting access to these larger portions. The tax piece, I'm not as confident about whether that would be as effective.
Mm-hmm. I don't have much to add to that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, I had a question about the brain effects of obesity. Is that related at all to, or does it cause, because I understand that overeating can affect the same pleasure centers as other addictive drugs. So is this related to that, where there's like death of cells that people don't get as much pleasure, or is
it? Right. What I was talking about is not exactly what you're referring to, but there probably is some correlation. So you're talking about something that's slightly different, but all the evidence is that these things are sort of overlapping, and they all are going in the same direction, which is that by consuming food and larger portions of food, the system's fatigue, if you will, and want more food. And then the regulating centers have difficulty sensing what the right amount of fat to have in a body is in those who are susceptible. I mean, interestingly, and it looks like in animal studies, there are animals who maintain a normal body weight. And no matter how much fattening food you give them, you can find animals who maintain a normal body weight. Those animals seem, even though those areas of the hypothalamus are injured, they get repaired. And so there's a lot of work going on now trying to figure out how do you repair these centers. But would that be good? Does that overcome the effect of eating, quote-unquote, fattening foods? Those are very complex issues that are going to take years to sort out.
So the animals that would prefer to drink sugar-sweetened beverage, and so they stop eating their solid food, but do they not gain weight?
Those animals do gain weight. They gain a significant amount of weight.
Because I remember a while ago, people, you know, studying obese rats, you know, it's one thing to study a genetically obese rat, and they're trying to get normal rats to gain weight, and they just found, you know, giving them Oreo cookies and Fritos to the
rat. You can give a number of different things to animals, and they'll gain weight. And then, you know, there are even mice where you give them, they're very, very efficient, you give them normal mouse chow and they become obese. So you have to pick the right models. I'm not a mouse doctor, I'm a human doctor, but my colleagues tell me that you have to pick the right models. But generally, there are models where you can give fattening foods, so saturated fats, you can give sugars, and you see the same pattern of obesity, and they're remarkably similar to what goes on in humans.
So do you think that limiting consumption of soda will help obesity?
Do I think, it's not a treatment for obesity, and this is where there's been a tremendous amount of confusion in policy. So saying that, okay, we removed soda from schools and yet children didn't lose weight, that to me is not, that's ominous. Like if I were a soda company, I would be worried by that because that says, uh-oh, we did something that is not turning around, and that is not a good sign. You know, that supports, you know, the trend. So that's a prevention of further weight gain and preventing other, you know, children from not gaining weight. That's not treatment of obesity.
But it's, you know, a step in the direction towards the overall epidemic.
But I just want it to be clear because I've seen a number of things quoted in the media saying that, oh, you know, things like this will not work because when you take sugar-sweetened beverages out of an environment, we don't see weight loss. I would not expect that to happen.
Has the obesity epidemic leveled off? I thought I saw recently some statistics talking about that.
For a given year, maybe it will. And we don't expect it to go up to 100% of the population. There's always going to be part of the population that's resistant. So I wouldn't expect it to just keep going up and up and up until every single person is, although some people have predicted that, you know, that'll happen in you know, within 100 years, everybody will. I don't think that's going to happen.
But has it leveled off actually?
For a short period of time, it did, but then the most recent statistics show that it took another increase. Mm-hmm. So depends on the year. But again, when you look at the volume of it, when 3/4 of the population is obese, and when you look at the cost in billions of dollars, and again, forget the obesity, it's the diabetes. And we're talking about things that have never been seen in the history of the world, like seeing some kids less than 20 years old developing adult diabetes. To me, that is, it's like, as a doctor, I was with our pediatric endocrinologist yesterday, and we're looking at this saying, like, this is unbelievable. This is unprecedented stuff. That's what's worrying us so much and makes us realize that something really bad is going on. So if I'm not a public health official, but when, you know, you're a public health official, you want to do something drastic in a situation like that. If this were an infectious disease and I came to you and said I have four index cases of 19-year-olds who have this illness and they shouldn't have it for 40 or 50 years, you know, what would you do? You would like start a quarantine or something. You would start some type of a mass program to prevent it. And I think that that's the kind of response you're seeing from the Department of Health to try to protect people. That's really what they're trying to do. People are looking at this as owner. They're trying to protect people from this. And this is one response. And again, I don't want to make it sound like, you know, we're talking about something that's overly dramatic, but when you're a public health official, there are only certain things that you can do. Here's the point I'm making. Like when you're a regulator, there are only certain things that you can do. You can't tax something. All you can do is try to control the things that you can control. I work with the Food and Drug Administration all the time. They can only do certain things to regulate medications. Mm-hmm. They can't do everything they would like to do because the rules they have only allow them to do certain things. And, you know, like sometimes we can't understand what they're doing, but after years of working with them, you see that they do this because they can. Once they approve a drug, they actually can't take it off the market. They can. They have to ask a company to do that. No one really understands that. So they, you know, that's why they've gotten, why they've made it so difficult for drugs to get approved, because they can't take a drug off the market. So people like myself have said, fine, make it possible for them to take a drug off the market so that we can have more medications, and then if there's a problem, take it off the market sooner. We don't want a company selling something that's not good for people. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Sure.
I'm also wondering about, there's a talk about how the size of the movie theaters, they're not small enough. So would it, the other angle be somehow forcing movie theaters and restaurants to make available smaller portions instead of taking away the larger portions?
No, again, I'm not a regulator. I don't know how the regulations can work and what can be regulated. But again, the second part of this is the economic incentive. So, you know, I'll tell you about a little experiment I did with my daughter when she's 25 now. She was much, much younger. And this was back in the 90s. And, you know, back then they still had small, medium, and large soda. And small was 70 cents, a medium was 80 cents, and a large, which was twice the size, was 90 cents. But it was only 20 cents more. She was like 8 or 9 years old. I said, which soda should we get? She said, what am I, stupid? Do you think I'm stupid, Daddy? The large soda. Like, you know, an 8 or 9 year old can do the math and figure out that the large soda is the soda to buy. So the economic incentive, I think, also is there. So is a city government going to regulate that you can't have an economic incentive in sodas? That, I think, is not realistic. That is onerous. Unless they were to tax, you know, the bigger the size portion, the more the tax, I think that's where it's getting difficult. So I think they're trying to regulate what they can regulate. Mm-hmm.